Welcome to this week's edition of The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. The roar of race car engines is back in the first state this week as Dover International Speedway hosts its spring NASCAR weekend. But this year is a bit different for the Monster Mile. 2019 marks 50 years of NASCAR racing at the Dover track. The ride started with the Mason-Dixon 300 on July 6, 1969. And since then, the one-mile oval has seen its share of highs and lows, largely mirroring NASCAR's trajectory through the years. This week, contributor Larry Nagengast charts the track's history and takes a peek at what lies ahead in his piece, available right now at DelawarePublic.org. And he and I recently sat down to discuss it all. So let's go back to the beginning of 50 years ago. The thing that always strikes me as curious is how did Dover wind up with a racetrack? At the time, 50 years ago, NASCAR was predominantly a Southern sport.
Well, yeah, it certainly was. And Dover, when you think about it, was really pretty much a dream come true for three men who had, you know, really larger than life personalities and an incredible ability to get things done. Let's talk about who they were. First of all, it was Dave Buxton, who was a Middletown native who would move into Kent County, and he became a Republican Party political leader, and he served the state both as Attorney General and Lieutenant Governor, and he also had a tremendous fondness for horses. Second, there was Melvin Joseph, who was a big-time Sussex County contractor who later became known for financing an expedition that discovered a sunken Spanish treasure ship off the Florida Keys. And he was the auto racing fan. And then there was John Rollins, Big John, who moved up from Georgia, opened a Ford dealership in Lewis, and really became, for his time, a very successful serial entrepreneur. He was the finance guy. So what happened here was that Buxton drew up the plan. He was looking at the idea of having a horse racing track inside the larger oval for the auto racing track. Mel Joseph built the structure, and John Rollins did everything he possibly could, including covering some of the debts in those early years to make sure that it became profitable.
And there was a time early on that the horses were bigger than the cars, right?
Well, yeah, absolutely. I mean, when the track opened, as you mentioned, NASCAR was essentially a Southern sport. Horse racing was pretty much the only legal gambling option around. You know, and so at the start, Dover offered both thoroughbred and harness racing. The thoroughbreds didn't last long, about 4 or 5 years. The opening of big tracks in larger urban areas, like the Meadowlands outside New York City, took care of that. Now harness racing was originally so popular in Dover that it wasn't unusual for 30 or 40 busloads of fans to arrive in Dover on snowy Sunday afternoons in January and February. And I mean, it is really amazing. But what's happening here was that Delaware was one of the few states and the only one in the area that allowed Sunday racing. So after a while, the other states caught on. They legalized racing on Sunday. Off-track betting came in and simulcasting. And all of these things combined to make going to the track less essential. And, you know, in terms of, you know, if you wanted to bet on the horses, you could bet on the horses just about anywhere. You didn't have to go to Dover to bet on the horses racing in Dover. And the harness racing just gradually fell off. And as harness racing faded, and of course, there still is racing the horses at Dover, but as the popularity of harness racing phase fell down, NASCAR influence started to grow.
At the time, it was kind of fortuitous, I guess, for the track. And in your piece, you note that current Dover Motorsport president and CEO Dennis McGlynn points to kind of what he calls kind of a turning point, a moment he feels that made NASCAR and Dover really take off. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, okay, it was February in 1979, and this was at a time when the Super Bowl was still held in January, so the football season was a little bit shorter. There was a lot less in the way of options for sports fans in the middle of winter. And this particular weekend in February of 79, there was a massive snowstorm that blanketed the East Coast. So pretty much if you wanted to get your sports fix that particular Sunday, what you had to do was watch the Daytona 500, which was NASCAR's signature race. And that race delivered plenty of excitement that year. Cale Yarborough and Donnie Allison were racing for the lead on the final lap, and then they crashed into each other at just shortly before hitting the finish line. And that allowed Richard Petty to sneak in and claim the prize and win first place. And then as the race ended, Allison and Yarborough got into it in the infield and got into a massive fist fight, a hockey type brawl, and Donnie Allison's brother Bobby even got into it as well, and it was quite a scene. And this just instantly, as far as McGlynn was concerned, expanded NASCAR's fan base. Suddenly, Dennis McGlynn had a much easier time marketing this Southern sport north of the Mason-Dixon line, and Dover was pretty much on its way. And shortly after that, they just started adding grandstand seats, and the capacity of the stadium just grew and grew for 15 consecutive years, and those seats were filled just about every time. Add more seats, and more people came to fill them up.
I was going to say, I mean, this was a period really from that point on that was kind of, as you mentioned, kind of a 15-year golden era for NASCAR and for NASCAR in Dover. For those who may not remember, can you kind of outline just how big racing actually got here in the first state and why it built up to such a big thing for a while?
Well, I first of all, look at what NASCAR had at the time. They had an incredible group of drivers. They were highly competitive, and they had strong personalities that enabled them to build rabid fan bases. Now, you look at the people who won at Dover in the 80s and into the 90s. You've got names like Bobby Allison, Richard Petty, Bill Elliott, Dale Earnhardt, Rusty Wallace, Kyle Petty. Between 1980 and 1995, these guys just monopolized the NASCAR circuit and all did well at Dover. And then in the late 90s comes Jeff Gordon, who would win four races at Dover. And he was especially popular in Delaware because the DuPont Company was one of his major sponsors. And now if you look at this period, especially as you go into the 90s and move forward, DuPont is a prime sponsor through Gordon and MBNA, later Bank of America, but MBNA at this time was also the prime sponsor of the races at Dover. So you had the state's two largest businesses putting their muscle and their sponsorship behind what was going on. So in addition to all the fans for drivers like Allison and Gordon and so on coming out to the races, you also had this tremendous corporate support, which meant that Delaware residents who worked for these big companies were also going to the races.
And perhaps the most memorable race, and maybe the high watermark for NASCAR in Dover, came in September 2001, right after the 9/11 attacks. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, again, the race weekend fell just a week and a half after the 9/11 attacks. And now, pro football games, Major League Baseball, the NASCAR race in New Hampshire for that Sunday immediately following the attacks, all of that had been canceled. So this weekend, when the race in Dover was scheduled, was really the resumption of big time sports activities across the country. You know, and Dover was a particularly intense situation here. Now remember, the remains from the victims of the plane crash at the Pentagon were taken to the mortuary at Dover Air Force Base for identification. You know, and Dennis McGlynn recalls there were constant communications throughout that race week with the FBI, with the Secret Service, with all sorts of federal and state security and police agencies. He was telling me that they were getting reports of, you know, suspicious-looking people who were registering at hotels in Wilmington and, you know, down near the Rehoboth area, presumably with an interest in the race. But, you know, the level of suspicions there, security was at red alert levels. And, you know, then you take it the step further and you get closer to the race. NASCAR has never been short on patriotic demonstrations. So MBNA, which was the race sponsor, and the Dover Downs people got together and they bought American flags that they handed out to all the spectators as they arrived for the Sunday race. Now, the 135,000 fans that showed up that day, that was the all-time attendance record at Dover. And these folks waved their flags and they were hungry for a good time. So, and you know, this is how Dennis McGlynn put it to me. He said, they were chanting, USA, USA, USA. They were doing the wave. They were pounding on the grandstand. It was electrifying. And to be able to pull it off, it was a great thing. And then, to top it all off, the race was won by Dale Earnhardt Jr. just 9 months after his father had been killed in a fiery crash at Daytona.
It was a remarkable weekend, and a lot of people forget. I mean, at that point, again, 135,000 fans. You mentioned, like, you know, NFL had restarted, baseball restarted, but this was probably that weekend the biggest event in terms of people. So the security piece was really kind of scary.
Yeah, most definitely was. Really, just hard to remember until you talk to the folks who were right there, you know, exactly how intense that situation was. I remember other components of this revival after 9/11. You know, I'm the security in New York when baseball resumed with a game between the Yankees and the Mets, and that same sort of intensity. But to see this essentially the largest sporting event in the country that weekend occurring in Dover, really amazing.
But through the 2000s, things always started to cool off for NASCAR and Dover. Why and just how far have things now fallen off?
Well, this growth that NASCAR had and that Dover had, I mean, it just wasn't going to last forever. But what really clobbered it was the recession of 2008. One of the first things that happens during an economic downturn is that the big companies trim their marketing budgets. And, you know, in Dover's case, that meant a loss of sponsorship revenue. I mean, you know, when we talked about, MBNA, which by then was Bank of America, but, them and heaven knows how many others were involved. But for Dover, the sponsorship revenue meant losing about 20,000 seats being filled each year. That, you know, these are people that the sponsor that would bring in their key clients and their top employees and so on. And there was really no easy way to make up for that loss. Why was that? Because NASCAR has this largely blue-collar fan base, and the recession puts so many of them out of work. So attendance was dropping. There's no longer a need for 135,000 seats, and having all those empty seats weren't going to look good on television with all these NASCAR races now being televised. So Dover officials gradually pared the size of the grandstand, and now the capacity there is about 85,000.
But this wasn't really a death knell for racing here, and that's really for a couple of reasons. The first has to do with NASCAR's business model. Can you explain how the business model has kind of kept that drop in attendance from really being a fatal blow?
Well, and look back, and we mentioned the Dover Daytona 500 back in 1979, and how that brought the NASCAR brand into the consciousness of sports fans in the North. You know, and then you think about the growth of cable television in that era. You've got ESPN coming on board, and then there were other networks, the Nashville Network, most prominently, that featured this blend of, you know, country music and sports car racing. So you've got both of those things going on. So NASCAR booms, so does its television revenue. Over the long term, this is going to mean that tracks didn't always have to be filled with fans, because as long as they're watching on television, the networks are going to reward NASCAR with lucrative contracts, and the racetracks always got a piece of that revenue pot.
And simultaneously, Dover Speedway has made some changes as well. What have they done to compensate, both in the racing realm and otherwise, to kind of maintain a viable business model?
Well, with fewer seats, Dover has worked to become far more fan-friendly. Having fewer seats has made this a lot easier. I mean, you know, when you think about it, you know, when you had 135,000 people packed in there, there wasn't a whole lot that you could do special for them. You know, you give them their seats and they're happy. But you know, with fewer fans, you can do more things. And so, take a look at, you know, like this weekend in particular. But you know, they've already installed a fan zone. They've got lots of exhibits and interactive programming, things like that for kids to do. And now this weekend, 50th anniversary celebration, they're going to have Q&A sessions with NASCAR drivers. They're going to have country music concerts, a big barbecue, a movie showing, fireworks, performances by the micro wrestlers and the Harlem Globetrotters. And then let's not forget about the food. NASCAR fans have been known for, you know, as a hot dogs, burgers, and fry crowd, and, you know, give them a soda and a couple of beers to wash it down, and that's pretty much what they were looking for. But, you know, this year, guests are going to be able to sample lagers created by craft brewers in Delaware, and they're going to be able to sample sandwiches, snacks, and other treats created by Sodell Concepts, which is well known for the group of restaurants that it operates in the Rehoboth area. As for the otherwise part of your question, well, back in 2012, Dover became home to Firefly, a new rock music festival that has been running for 3 or 4 days in late June now. Firefly has grown to become really the premier rock festival in the Northeast, and it's one of the more popular in the country. Now, it's not what you'd expect for a business focused on auto and harness racing to get into, but it does show that this track management is willing to try something new. But first, it carefully examines the risk-to-reward ratio before deciding where it's going.
Certainly with Firefly, the reward has certainly been there for Dover International Speedway. So what are the track's expectations now for race weekends and kind of going forward? What do they expect they'll be doing business-wise over the next 10, 15 years?
Well, again, let's go back to Firefly and put this in perspective, because it's a very interesting perspective. As we mentioned, you know, in NASCAR's glory days, you'd have 135,000 fans turning out for a Sunday race. Now, Firefly has become Dover's primary attraction. That brings in 90,000 to 95,000 music lovers for a three-day weekend. The expectation for Dover for a race weekend now is somewhere in the mid-40s range for each of the two Sunday races. So you add it up. The two Sunday races combined just about matches what you're getting for Firefly. Really, you know, an incredible turnaround transition. Now, this year, because it's the 50th anniversary, Dennis McGlynn thinks that the crowds could be bigger. But he's not quite sure how much bigger. But, you know, we're still talking, okay, instead of 40 to 45 or so, maybe you get up to 50, maybe you get a little over 50. It's not going to be anywhere near like it was 15 to 20 years ago. So now you fast forward a little bit. So where are we going to go? All this extra entertainment and all the activities surrounding the races, I mean, they're designed to do a couple of things. First of all, keep the current fan base interested, but more importantly, to try to draw more new fans to the track. They want to bring in the millennials and get the younger generation excited about races. But, you know, they're still dealing with the fact that there are thousands of different ways for people to spend their leisure time. You know, back in the day, there were, you know, maybe 10 television stations, and now there's, you know, there's hundreds of channels to deal with. And the number of entertainment options outside of the media has also multiplied. So it's quite a challenge for Dover and for NASCAR. But now you got, you know, keep in mind they do have this revenue model currently that relies heavily on television contracts. So it's not absolutely essential that every last seat will be filled. So you look down the road, and where does this all take you? Well, you know, you've got the internet, you've got people watching the races on their phones now. You've got developments with virtual reality where, you know, who knows, you know, McGlynn is talking about, you know, you put on the virtual reality glasses and you pay $5 and you're able to watch, not just watch the race, but put yourself on the track and virtually racing around the track with the drivers. The possibilities here are still, they're imaginable, but in some extent beyond your imagination as well.
And do they see any additional expansion beyond racing in Firefly? Other things that they can do at the property?
Well, I'm going to say yes, but it's a kind of an iffy sort of situation. A couple of years ago, Dover explored the possibility of hosting the annual Punkin' Chunkin' competition on the first weekend in November. But not only was the track itself too small to accommodate these mechanized gourd tossers, but, you know, so was the Woodlands, the area where Firefly is held. You know, and logistically, they tell me the only way it would have worked would have been if they had been blasting pumpkins and having them catapult over Route 1. But, you know, you've got some risks of a misfire here, and that was just a little too great for them to consider. That said, you know, the preparation for the races is pretty intense for a month or so in advance. So depending upon how NASCAR builds its schedule, you know, the only times open for a big event now would be late October, early November, and possibly in April. And in both those time frames, you know, weather is always an issue, and there are, you know, certainly lots of other established events nationwide, particularly in the springtime. So Dover's management, it's fair to say, you know, they're looking for ideas. They haven't latched on to one yet. You know, and you and I were talking the other day about the grandstand possibly becoming a stop for touring rock and country music acts, and but then again, established performers might not want to take a shot at a venue here that doesn't have a track record, shall we say, for, you know, producing large-scale concerts. Lots of people would like to see Dover get more use, but, you know, as you tell, you know, we're not quite sure what that might be. But then again, you know, 8 years ago, Firefly was a big surprise to all of us. So, you know, who knows? Maybe they've got, another big surprise up their sleeves.
Thanks to contributor Larry Nightingale for his time on The Green this week. You can find his piece on Dover International Speedway's 50th anniversary online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Next, we head to the University of Delaware's Star Campus to learn about research incorporating virtual reality with the help of UD intern contributor DJ McCauley. Stay tuned for that here on The Green on Delaware Public Media.